two of a kind, so sister, I'm keeping my eyes on you. I bet you think I don't know nothing but singing the blues. Oh, sister, have I got news for you? I'm something. I hope you think that you're something too.
Greetings, WBAI listeners. Welcome to Women, Body, and Soul, dialogues on women's health, relationships, and sexuality with holistic multicultural perspectives. This is 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio, New York City. I'm your host, Natalie Tondiway. In today's show, we'll discuss the anthology Naked, Black Women Bare All About Their Hair, Skin, Hips, Lips, and Other Parts, with co-editors Akiba Solomon and Ayanna Bird. The book Naked is a collection of original essays and memoirs about Black women and body image. Naked co-editor and guest Akiba Solomon is a freelance writer and editor from West Philadelphia. A graduate of Howard University, she has served in editorial capacities at magazines including The Source, Essence, and Vibe Vixen. Ms. Solomon has written for a number of publications including Glamour, Redbook, Jane, Vibe, Uptown, Paws, and Color Lines. She is a speaker and panelist on women's and social justice issues through the lens of hip-hop culture. She is part of the BET News special Hip-Hop vs. America, an award-winning town hall-style program. Co-editor Ayanna Bird is author of the award-winning Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. A Barnard College graduate and Philadelphia native, she was the founding deputy editor of Vibe Vixen, and her writing has appeared in Essence, Latina, Rolling Stone, Vibe, Paws, and Suede magazines. Ms. Bird's personal essays have appeared in The Fire This Time, Young Activists and New Feminism, and Split, Stories from a Generation Raised on Divorce. Ms. Bird is currently an articles editor at Glamour magazine. Welcome, Akiba and Ayanna. Thank you for joining us here on Women, Body, and Soul.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great.
Okay. So I have to thank you for this wonderful anthology, Naked. It was a bittersweet pleasure for me to read. I welcome the space that you created for us to hear Black women telling their own stories of how their sense of beauty and self-esteem has been shaped. It was also painful to see the realities of colorism and racism and just hostility toward Black women in both Black communities and the dominant culture, and how deeply some of us have been hurt and troubled, even from our youngest years. And for me, it also brought back a lot of memories of just crazy and difficult times that my friends and I went through as we dealt with the negative ways the world perceives us as Black women, as we try to develop a sense of self and figure out where we fit in and, you know, how to believe in our beauty and our lovableness. What was it like for you working on this project and, you know, bringing it to press?
Well, I'm sorry, this is Akiba speaking, and Ayanna is going to come on after I speak.
Oh, okay.
Your question about whether or not it was painful to work on the book, I'd have to say that, as you said, it was bittersweet, because on the one hand, it was a way for us to create a platform not only for ourselves and some of the writers that we know, but also everyday women to just really talk about an issue that we all, I think, feel, but it's very rare that there's ever any above board discussion about it. It's just sort of in a void somewhere that we feel, and a lot of times it's right under the surface. With that said, you know, it was a blessing, and at times it could feel like a curse because these essays were so personal that you really did have to kind of walk through them with people. Mm-hmm. And since people really revealed a lot, you were kind of living it with them.
Absolutely. One of the things I was saying to my husband is that the essays are so personal and just revealing of the types of thoughts and feelings that people don't usually share beyond sort of the privacy of their inner self, or, you know, maybe with a therapist. But, you know, I was saying that reading the essays kind of brought to mind the line in the song Killing Me Softly. You know, I felt he found my letters and read each one aloud as I went through them. You know, I just and as I said, it was, you know, definitely bittersweet was how I would sum it up. But to have sometimes after reading an essay, I would reflect and I would think, God, I would think about what it took to be so honest about things that are so painful and so revealing and that are just on the page for the world to see. I'm wondering, did you see contributors struggle with being this honest in their process?
Well, I'll let Ayana weigh in on on whether or not it took a lot for the contributors to do so. Here she goes.
Hi.
Hey, Ayana. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Oh, excellent. I was just saying to Akiba that there's just a deep privacy and just deeply personal thoughts that are revealed in the course of the essays, and I was just wondering if the contributors struggled with being this revealing in their process.
I think, yes, there was definitely, I don't want to say a struggle, but there was an intense editing process for all of the essays.
Mm-hmm.
We approached it by asking everyone just to write a paragraph about their bodies and what it is that they would want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people said, oh, I don't really have anything to write about. And then they would turn in something about 4 pages long.
Oh,
and we would
wow.
say, no one's ever going to see this except for the two of us. This is not in any way going to be published. It's just so you can get your ideas out and we can see what it is that you want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they started the actual essay writing process, usually what we got was something that was good but very surface.
Mm-hmm.
Very, this happened, and then this happened, and then when I was 12, this happened, and it was chronological, and it really was very fact-based and not emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually took about 2 more edits for us to really get them to uncover what they really wanted to talk about, aside from just the facts of what was going on. I think the pregnancy essay by Lori Tharps is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
She expected to write an essay about the changes that her body went through when she was pregnant, and no more, no less, which I think is an interesting essay, but it turned out to be an essay that started in the fields of Mississippi when her grandmother was carrying her mother.
Mm.
And it wove in so much history about her family and about her childhood and ideas, things that happened before she was even alive that influenced how she felt about herself when she was pregnant with her oldest son. And she had no idea that was the essay that she was going to write until the second or third draft. So I think for everyone, it was a real excavation of things that they hadn't really thought about or hadn't really connected the dots with.
Mm, yeah, that's how I felt reading it. It just brought back all of these memories of things that I don't think I've thought about since high school, and some of them even earlier than that, just of, you know, that process of growing up and sort of figuring out where you fit in and, you know, all of the things that all teens go through, regardless of race, just dealing with really sort of difficult or painful situations and, you know, moving on and becoming who you are,
right,
sort of in spite of it all. One of the things that I love about this anthology is that, you know, there are over 26 essays, and there it seems like every possible perspective and experience appears somewhere, you know, among when you look over the field of the 26. I'm just curious, how did you go about finding the contributors?
We went about finding the contributors by there were so many different ways. We started out with a wish list of people that we would want. So we knew some of those people. Some of those people, we had just read their work before, and we reached out to everyone on our wish list. And about half came through. Sonia Sanchez was on our wish list, and
mm-hmm.
Jill Nelson. And then also there were people that we were very close with, like Akiba's sister, Asali Solomon, who is an author, and we really wanted to contribute. And I imagine we would have wanted her to contribute even if we didn't know her.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously she was an easy person to approach. But then there were also people, a lot of the As Told To's, 13 of the pieces in the book are not written, but they were done by interviews that we did with women, usually about 3 interviews that then were pieced together to turn into what you read.
Mm-hmm.
One of the women we actually, Akiba found, and she can talk about this in a little more detail, she found her in an article in O Magazine. And she did not write the article, but she was mentioned in it, and we thought her story just sounded incredible. And actually, let me pass this to Akiba.
So the woman, Cynthia Berry, she's actually in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility.
Oh, yes, I remember her essay.
Right, and so she participated in a writing workshop that Eve Ensler did. And when I read about her in O and I saw her picture in O, I was just so struck by the fact that, you know, here's a sister who is just locked away, and I felt like there had to be more to her story. And so, you know, we just drafted a letter and we sent it to her, and we knew that she was a writer because she had done this workshop, and we knew that she felt comfortable to a certain extent about writing about her body because, again, she participated in this eventual workshop. And so, you know, it just went from there. And she actually submitted her essay in a series of handwritten letters that we then called together to create what appeared in the book.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk, as I, you know, we'll explore some of the themes in the essays later, but her essay was, I read it a couple of times. It's really stunning, and it definitely kind of made me catch my breath. And then, you know, one of the things you speak about in the introduction to the book is creating a safe space for dialogue about how we as Black women form our identities and our ideals and come to terms with relationships that we have with our own bodies. And I'm just curious, how have you seen this dialogue grow from the seed that you planted with your book?
Well, I think we've seen it grow in pockets. I mean, when we go and we do workshops or when we go and we speak to people, it starts off with people, it has started off with people floating one feeling maybe. Mm-hmm. And then someone will just sort of ping pong with them. And then you just suddenly have this conversation that a lot of people, even if they know each other, have never had before.
Right.
And so it's really, I think it's a really intuitive and organic process. And it's also surprising that so many people that we've seen with our own eyes are starved to talk about this because, you know, as we stated in the intro, there are a lot of women's body parts that we see now. You know, with Black women, we're more visible than ever in terms of what our bodies look like, our celebrities, video models, et cetera. You just see a lot of Black women's bodies, but you don't hear us. We don't really say anything about it. And when we do say something about it, it's usually within the context of how our man feels about our bodies or whether we're too fat or whether we're too thin, you know, whether or not our hair is right, whether or not our weave is tight. And so it's just a real, it's not a really productive discussion, I think, that we hear, if there is any discussion at all.
Listeners, we're talking about the book Naked, Black Women Bear All About Their Hair, Skin, Hips, Lips, and Other Parts, with co-editors Akiba Solomon and Ayanna Bird. The book is a collection of essays and memoirs about Black women and body image. Now, one of the things, you know, throughout the book, we see how for Black women, the sort of kind of what you were talking about with, you know, Black women are visible, their bodies are visible, but we don't hear much from them. And then, you know, all women, including Black women, are constantly getting messages about what their beauty ideal should be, what their bodies should look like. And one thing you point out is that for Black women, you know, the message is that what we're born with isn't going to get us very far. And throughout the book, we see how that particular message is compounded with, you know, more racially specific messages that say if you're born Black with, you know, distinctively Black or African features and, you know, distinctively Black or African hair, that what you're born with is going to get you even less.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing about that point is just that there's so much historical precedent for that sort of thinking. But it's one of those things that, you know, you feel it, but sometimes there's no smoking gun there. I mean, sometimes you wonder, is this just how I'm receiving things? And am I looking at this through the lens of low self-esteem? Is this really happening? And so, you know, it's a lot of that struggle isn't just about what's out in the world and what we sort of have evidence of through, you know, writings and through, you know, our history with slavery and our history just with white supremacy and how beauty is sort of filtered through that, beauty images are filtered through that. But it's also just the not knowing now, you know, the feeling that, you know, again, am I imagining this? Was that look that I got in the elevator by, you know, a white coworker, was she checking out my butt because it's too big, or is that in my mind, or, you know, what, is she wondering about my hair? Why do I care if she's wondering? I mean, it's really one of those sort of murky topics, I think.
Well, and I think you make an interesting point is that a lot of it is about lens, or the way our worldview or experience of seeing the world and being seen in the world. And I think that the other tricky part of that is that you can testify about what you're experiencing, and not get any support because the person you're testifying to doesn't necessarily have the same lens or the same, you know, isn't perceived in the world the same way.
Right.
And an example I can think of is when I was in undergraduate, I remember someone I was dating at the time, he had very dark skin. And I remember him saying to me, you know, that he felt like people treated him differently because of his skin color and because of the tone of his skin. And I remember saying to him, you know, we went to a historically black college, and I remember saying to him, I'm embarrassed now because I feel like I was basically saying to him, it's all in your imagination. That's crazy talk in this day and age. Mm-hmm. And I remember maybe later in the year, one of my good friends approaching me and telling me that my friend, like, you know, people in my social circle were talking about me behind my back because I was dating someone with very dark skin. And so, you know, and so here, you know, two things were happening. One, I couldn't believe that people were having a conversation like that. And two, what my lover was telling me was actually true. And I had not really believed him or supported him when he told me because it wasn't the same lens that I was experiencing the world through or being experienced through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what makes all of this kind of murky because it's perception based. And then people might not believe you or might challenge you, and it kind of can leave you stuck with your perceptions.
And, I mean, you bring up an interesting issue, too, in terms of how we treat one another and how we see one another through our own lens, because it's incredibly painful for anybody of any complexion to deal with, again, just the vestiges of white supremacy, but we're all having this conversation and we're not putting a name on it.
Right.
And so, you know, to have someone who you love confront you with feelings of inadequacy, I suppose, mm-hmm. around this, and, you know, if you aren't the same complexion, to have to deal with that, I mean, that makes it really, really difficult. And I think that it can have a toll on relationships. And it's just a tragedy to me. I mean,
it is a tragedy. And that's, that's what I meant by bittersweet when I talked about how I felt in reading the book, is that there's a part of this that is so bitter. And it's the part that you're calling a tragedy. Mm-hmm. When you read these stories of the just the deep wounds and the deep pain that a lot of the women testify to, pain that goes all the way back to their girlhood, mm-hmm. About how they are perceived or treated because of their innate features and the blackness of their features or the darkness of their skin or the, you know, the kink of their hair. And a lot of this actually comes from other black people. And some of it from family members. And so it makes it seem like there is no safe space to sort of unfold and become comfortable with yourself and believe that you're beautiful, as Sonia Sanchez points out, that it is so critical for us to believe.
It is critical. I'm actually going to have Ayana weigh in on just how critical it is for us to believe that we are beautiful and to define ourselves based on who we are. So here she goes.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat? Just a quick.
We were just speaking about just some of the pain that people speak of in the book in terms of being treated, ill-treated based on colorism, based on people insisting that they aren't beautiful because they have black features or hair that is distinctively black.
Right.
And just sort of how in the foreword, and we can talk about that some more, Sonia, one of the things Sonia Sanchez reminds us is that it is so important for us to come into believing that we are beautiful and that we are smart. And what a difficult thing this is to do in an environment where you're constantly getting the message that if you're born black with black features and black hair, that as Akiva points out, you know, you're going to not get very far with that is the message that you're receiving over and over.
It's true. And I'm sorry I interrupted. We don't live in a society that encourages us to feel good about how we look. And I think you can find anyone who can say that. Even a white woman who fits every mainstream ideal of what is supposed to, quote unquote, be beautiful still has issues and is still being told that she could do something better. So once you get to black women, black people in general, we're so far down the totem pole of what even general society is saying is beautiful, let alone within our own communities are feeling are beautiful, that it's nearly impossible to look for external cues to feel good about ourselves. And I think another thing that really harms us is that we're all told that issues of beauty are not important. Mm-hmm. So,
right, that they're superficial.
Exactly. So even though you are being told by media, by family, by friends, by men that you may or may not know what looks good, what they want, what they're interested in, what you should look like, we're then told, well, all of those messages may be coming to you nonstop, but really they're not supposed to be important. So the fact that you're even spending any time thinking about them is showing that you're just being really, there's something wrong with you.
Right, you're being superficial and you need to grow up.
Yes, and silly and girlish. Meanwhile, that's obviously I don't agree with that or else I wouldn't have done an entire book about it. But one of the first things is we have to accept we have to allow ourselves the space to know that this is an important thing to focus on. It's a huge part of our identities. It's a huge part of our self-esteem. And we're allowed the space to, A, think about it and react to it, but also to discuss it with people that we trust and know. And to challenge it without thinking that we should just be, that we should shut up and go away and it's just some silly woman's issue.
Well, and then I think you bring up an important point, which is this trivial or isn't it trivial? And one of the things that you discuss in the introduction is some of the disturbing statistics and trends among Black women, which I think points to the fact that this is real and that it's not trivial. We're the fastest rising group of women being diagnosed with eating disorders.
Yes.
We are dangerously overweight and obese. We are increasingly using cosmetic surgery to alter our native features. And we spend over $12 billion annually to change the texture of our hair, often straightening it or purchasing hair with characteristics of European hair to cover or disguise our natural hair.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, often we hear about Black men spoken of as being in crisis, but when you consider these sort of statistics and the testimonies of the women who share their stories with us in this anthology, Naked, it's very clear that Black women are also in crisis.
We are. We do not leave our homes every day to face the world, to face all of the things that the world can put on you, feeling good about ourselves. That's a huge thing. When we step outside to face everything else, we don't even feel as though we're bringing our best selves.
And, you know, and then one of the things pointed out throughout the book is that depending on your features, you might not even feel that you're attractive within your own community.
Right.
Based on whatever is valued at the moment.
Go ahead.
I want to discuss some of the themes that are threaded throughout the stories that each woman shares in the book. And listeners, we're talking about the book Naked, Black Women Bear All About Their Hair, Skin, Hips, Lips, and Other Parts with co-editors Akiba Solomon and Ayanna Bird here on Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York. So as I said, I wanted to talk about these themes. And if we look at, I was very struck by the foreword by Sonia Sanchez. It was so simple, yet so deep, as so much of her writing is. And she talks about an episode in which she is working late in the evening at the mayor's office when she was a college professor and leaving the meeting and having a man mistake her for a prostitute. And what she's really talking about is the pain of dealing with when people don't really see you, they just see a stereotype. Mm-hmm. When it registers that you're Black and female, and in this case it's the stereotype of, you know, a Black woman on the street being a prostitute. And I think her words are so eloquent. You know, she talks about the fact that we might be taught to become smart and to believe that we're smart, but we are never really taught to believe that we are beautiful. But beyond that, she says that it is just really critical that Black women can't really be effective in the world if we're crippled at that level, and that part of our wholeness is really knowing that we are both Black and beautiful. And also, you know, that we can only be able to defend ourselves against people who regard us as anything less when we know this, when we have this innate understanding that we are Black and beautiful. And this isn't really something that I've heard said in quite this way before. I'm curious if you can comment on Sonia's piece.
Well, her piece was one of the things that's most incredible about the foreword, and this isn't getting exactly to your question yet, but She actually did not write it. She spoke it to us over the phone. And she just speaks like that. And for anyone who reads it in our book, it's amazing how eloquent she is, even in just a phone conversation.
Wow.
And how much truth there is in everything that she says, because it is true. We cannot, you know, there, I think we need to, as Black women, we have to, actually, let me go back. I don't think just as Black women, as people, we need to all have a new way of seeing beauty, and it has to be individual. We have to rewire our brains to see beauty as what is in front of us, not as only if your hair is this texture is it beautiful, only if your skin fits within this range of shades is it beautiful, only if you're this tall, only if you weigh this much. I mean, we can't look at one fixed thing or maybe two or three fixed things as beautiful and then turn to someone who doesn't have that and be like, oh, but you're beautiful too. I mean, everyone knows that sounds like, it feels like a cop-out. I had a conversation the other day with a friend who was looking at a picture of herself and really didn't like how she looked in the picture, and she said she looked fat. And I said, what are you talking about? And she's not at all. And she didn't like how her hips looked in the picture. And as we were talking, I said, well, you have hips. A lot of women have hips. Hips are beautiful. If you actually don't think hips are beautiful, then you're never going to see yours as beautiful. And I think that goes for a lot of things with this. If you do not think that brown skin can possibly be beautiful, then you're never going to be okay with how you are. And so if we're always looking outside of something that's not ourselves, we're never going to feel beautiful enough, and we're never going to feel confident enough. And I think that's one of the things that Akiva and I really tried to do with the book. You mentioned earlier that there's such a, almost, you felt there was almost every possible perspective was in there. We wanted that. We did not want this book to be, this is how Ayana and Akiva feel. We wanted it to be, this is how these 26 women feel. But also, within these 26 individual stories, hopefully you can find something that resonates with your own story and feel that you can go on and have your own discussions or write your own story.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think that I'm going to carry Sonia's words with me forever when she says, you must say this is who I am forever, and I am indeed beautiful and smart.
Yes, we have to tell ourselves that. And sometimes it's just words. Sometimes you're just saying it to yourself without any real belief behind it. But the more you say it, the more you believe it. And of course, 100% of the time is the goal. But even if we can get to 90% of the time really believing that we are beautiful, I think that's such a revolutionary thing that changes everything.
And then your essay, and I want to make sure I pronounce it correctly, is it Piropos?
Piropos.
Piropos. You talk about the never-ending street drama of being approached disrespectfully by men and the intense hostility and even violence from certain men if we don't respond with interest. And I'm curious, how have Black men responded to your essay?
That's a funny question, because when the book came, first of all, it's funny to think about my essay right now towards the end of the winter, because in New York, everything changes in the winter because you're walking around wearing like the equivalent of a comforter.
Right.
So the comments really decrease.
Right.
But when the book came out, I was working at Vibe Vixen magazine, and we shared office space with the main magazine, with Vibe, which was at least 50% men, I would say. So I was around a lot of men every day when the book came out. Now I'm not at Glamour. There's very few men who work here.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very small, and I'm pretty perky. Mm-hmm. And they were, I think, really, a lot of men were shocked. Oh, I didn't know you were so angry.
Mm.
And I said, well, who wouldn't be angry at the things that I'm talking about in the book? Like, if that happened to anyone and the response wasn't angry, like, the man who was screaming after me down the street, or the men who chased me through the lobby of my old apartment building. Like
the pit bull story was really the scariest.
Yes, it was. It was scary. I was really happy.
How
that
did
I had
you get
speakers.
Out of that?
I run fast, and they were drunk, and they weren't that interested in, I don't think they were interested in showing off for each other.
Okay.
I don't think they were interested in catching up with me. And so once I ran, and the lobby is, it was really long, and then I just went up the steps, and I think they were more interested in showing each other what they could do and then going back outside to finish their 40s.
Mm.
So luckily, that's what they were interested in, because then I would have had a whole different essay to write if
right.
they had actually wanted to catch up with me. Because even though I run fast, they, I'm sure a dog can outrun me.
Right.
But, yeah, a lot of men were like, oh, I didn't know you were so bitter. I didn't know you were so angry. But then other men also said they really, really thought about it. And even if they weren't the man who's ever said something to a woman on the street, they have often been with men who might say something to a woman on the street. And they said they'd never really stopped and thought about, and these aren't men who would say disgusting things to women on the street, but just anything, they'd never thought about what it's like to really invade someone's personal space when they're just trying to get
from point A to point B.
Right. And I was happy that even in the beginning, a lot of the comments were, oh, I didn't know you were so angry. When I would really sit and have conversations with people, a lot of men said it really changed their thinking about how, and a couple of men have also told me that they've now stepped in and helped women out when they've seen a woman on the subway and a guy just keeps talking to her, especially on the subway, you're trapped. So if a man decides to sit next to you and just keep talking to you and saying whatever he wants, there's but so much that you can do, and you don't know if you want to get up and go to the next car, because if he follows you, is he going to become even more aggressive because now he's had to make the effort to get up and follow you? And a couple of men have told me that they now help women out if they see that they're in a hard situation with a man on the street, which
well,
made me
great.
Feel great. It's great.
Oh, my goodness. And then I wanted to, one of the other essays, of course you can all, either of you can comment, but Black Fuzzy Thing by Asali.
Yes. I'm actually going to have Akiba comment because that's her sister.
Okay.
Hold on.
So can you repeat the question?
Yeah, I was just saying I wanted to sort of go through some of the themes in the essays. And, you know, I was thinking I wanted to talk about Asali Solomon's essay, Your Sister,
right.
Black Fuzzy Thing. And, you know, she talks about living in a society that says black hair is undesirable for women, that kinky natural hair is especially undesirable and unfeminine.
Right.
And just the conflict, you know, one of the things that strikes me is she talks about the conflict between the standard of beauty and the standard of, quote, black consciousness.
Right.
And how she has to sort of grapple with these two ends. And I don't think this is something that people talk about a lot, especially in the sort of down and nappy community. You know, you're just supposed to be like, okay, this is your, you know, it's like everyone gets a little party line postcard at the beginning of the day and an ID, and it's like, you know, you get it stamped and you go, okay, you're conscious, here's your natural hair.
Right.
You know, here's your up with people.
Right.
And be happy about it. And you're not supposed to talk about any conflict you feel about the messages that you're getting about your choices, you know, whether they're great and conscious or, you know, whatever people are deeming them. But there's nothing within the community that says, okay, well, here's how to deal with some of the conflict that's going to arise from being a woman and choosing to wear your hair naturally, especially as you're growing up, as you're a girl, and this is how you should deal with it. And I was, again, struck by her honesty. And, you know, how she speaks about this conflict of getting the message that, you know, your natural hair is so undesirable and getting the message that you need to have a standard of consciousness.
Right. I mean, that was sort of a pet project, I think, of Ayana's and mine, that not only do we affirm women and affirm black women through just showing that we need to define our beauty for ourselves, but also to make it okay that even if you know that this is supposed to be wrong, to not feel okay all the time about your natural hair, to not feel okay all the time about the shape of your nose or your lips or your hips or whatever, but even if you know that intellectually that there is going to be some conflict, because how, you know, why wouldn't there be conflict? And so it's just, you know, that was something that we really wanted to do, to make sure that we allowed for some contradictions in the book, because I think that's really a human experience. But on top of that, I mean, again, when you compound it with racism and you compound it with sexism, it just gets really complicated.
Mm.
And, you know, just to, because Asali is my sister, I mean, you know, it's really interesting to, it was interesting to read her piece, and I didn't edit it because I was too close to it. Ayana did, but, you know, to read her piece and see how we were similar and how we were different and how we received and then sort of manifested the messages that we got in our household. And there were moments in her piece that I actually remembered quite differently. And so, you know, that was another layer for me as the editor of the book, you know, to just look at this picture of the household that I grew up in through the lens of my big sister, you know.
You know, I want to take a short break, and then when we come back, I want to actually discuss your essay, The Free Black Woman. Listeners, we're talking about the book Naked, Black Women Bare All, about their hair, skin, hips, lips, and other parts, with Akiba Solomon and Ayana Byrd.
You've been on my mind, oh, sister. We're two of a kind, so, sister. I'm keeping my eyes on you.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you've always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with people and to be with yourself as well. Tune into The Positive Mind Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.
Listeners, we're talking about the book Naked, an anthology about black women and bearing all about their hair, skin, hips, lips, and other parts with co-editors Akiba Solomon and Ayana Byrd. This is 99.5 FM WBAI New York City, also streaming live online at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Natalie Tondiway, and it's Women, Body, and Soul. All right, Akiba, welcome back. I wanted to talk about your essay, The Free Black Woman. One of the things that you talk about in your essay is, you know, coming of age and the message you get being that light skin. Well, you make some interesting observations about light skinned girl privilege,
right?
And you talk about this process of witnessing it and sort of saying to yourself, okay, well, where does that leave a brown girl like me? And you say without hope. And you've kind of got this equation where you say lightness equals more power and more options based on your observations,
right?
And I'm just curious, how, you know, what were the ages at which you were processing this information? Did this start very young for you, or was this something specific to high school?
I think it started in high school. I think it might have started earlier if I had gone to elementary school with more black children, but because I was in a predominantly white, all-female environment from third grade to eighth grade, I was insulated to a certain extent from the daily commentary. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I knew that light skin privilege existed.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had a, like, sort of a gnawing feeling that there was something wrong, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until high school that I had people actually come up and assess my skin color, you know, just come up in conversation even and say, you know, oh, the dark skin Joan, or oh, the, you know, however people described it. I mean, again, before I went to high school, I didn't even know that I was considered dark skin. because right. I had, and I'm brown skinned, mm-hmm. and as I say in the essay, if I was dark skinned, then that would be great. But, you know, I have people in my family who are a lot darker than I am, and I feel like if the scale stops at me, then, you know, do they exist at all?
Mm.
And so it just, you know, that was an incredibly difficult time, I think, because aside from just the usual adolescent drama that you have to come to understand, you know, to come to understand how things are set up and, you know, kind of belatedly was also a difficult thing.
I think one of the things I found really fascinating about your essay is, again, you know, and your sister does touch on some of this too, is that there is a whole intellectualization that goes along with having a political consciousness, and in
yes.
this case, Black nationalism, where it's like it's almost like you could get a point book
mm-hmm.
and be told, like, you know, Afro good, Dashiki good, freedom of the people good, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then like there could be another page with bad. But the problem with that is that in real life, we have all these experiences where we're interacting with other people and there's this like intersection of 1,000 different things, including like 400 years of slavery
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, all these other things and these interactions, plus the machine of the media and the beauty ideals.
Mm-hmm.
And so although we might be, you know, shrouding our children in this, you know, these cultural affirmations and Black consciousness, it doesn't necessarily protect them or prepare them for the emotional and social pain of, you know, dealing with these interactions, whether it's a predominantly white environment, white racism, or Black people's colorism, or the media. And then, you know, there can be so much conflict that you feel in the gap between, like, the rhetoric you might get in, at home and the actual, you know, experiences and feelings about the racism out in the world.
Well, you know, the interesting thing that you just mentioned about rhetoric within the home. I mean, you know, part of even writing my essay and reading my sister's essay and I guess allowing it to go in a book that I was half, you know, co-editor of, it took a lot of soul searching in terms of how much I was going to say about my family and about my upbringing, because you know, I still have a great deal of pride in how I was brought up, and I still feel like the intention was really healthy and that I've gotten tools that have really served me well in life. With that said, I think that, you know, any idea that is counter to the predominant idea is a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are so many ways that children can react to that. I mean, I've seen some kids who have grown up in this way who have changed their names to, you know, non-African names, will only wear weaves, will,
right.
you know, I
reactionary
mean,
responses.
Yeah.
To revolutionary childhood. Right.
Exactly. I mean, it's, but you know, that's not, again, it's not to negate your point about, mm-hmm. you know, the rhetoric and how you measure up to it. But it's just to say that, you know, I think we need a different toolkit. I think we all do. As Iyanna said, we have to have a reordering of how we look at ourselves. And that's everybody. Because if we continue to look at ourselves through the lens of other people, and also through the lens of media and this sort of, like, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but this sort of invisible hand of media, which is, you know, more and more exposure all the time, 24-hour-day news cycle, internet.
And incredibly influential in a way that people don't acknowledge or recognize.
Right. I mean, it's insidious. And, you know, Iyanna and I both work in media, and so we know how it works. And to be someone who isn't media literate, or to be someone growing up in this society right now and not, you know, a grown woman, I can only imagine what the next generation of girls are going to be thinking and feeling about how they look, because they are
yes.
so exposed and inundated with ideas of perfection.
Yes, I think about this all the time, and your essay really brought it back up, you know, into the forefront for me. I think to myself, like, I look at my stepdaughters and, you know, other young women, and I, you know, I think I look back on when I was coming up and when you were coming up, and I feel like it was a time, you know, it was a different time in hip hop. It was a different time in music and entertainment. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the media has always been what the media is, but it wasn't quite as slick and mechanized then. And it seemed like there was still some space for people to create original art and entertainment that wasn't just focused on sexualizing and eroticizing women as a way to sell things.
Right.
Even if you look back at some of the videos from the 80s and early 90s, women and men can often be wearing interchangeable clothes,
right,
like hoodies and baggy jeans.
Right.
And it just isn't the focus of the experience of connecting with the artist or the music or the entertainment.
Right. I mean, the shift overall to the blatant sexualization of women is really pronounced. And, you know, if you look at old videos, not only do you see women with just more clothes on, mm-hmm, you see women who look like
real people.
Real people. Yes, right. Like you actually, I was watching House Party on cable, I think 2 months ago. Or
oh my God, what's up with the hair?
But I mean, like,
no, I'm just teasing.
But the dime pieces, mm-hmm, at the House Party looked like women that I know, including
right,
myself. I mean,
right,
they were different variations, and there's still that line that that Play has when he's talking about the Tisha Campbell character, where he, mm-hmm, says she has good hair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still present. But the point is, visually, there are still women who may have been professional models or professional actresses, but they didn't look like professional models or actresses necessarily. They were just cute women who, or cute girls who were at a house party.
Yeah.
Now, if you had that scene,
oh my God,
I would be afraid to see what the cute girls at the house party would look like, because I don't think they would look like any of the women that I see every day.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was talking with my stepdaughter about this. And, you know, I was saying to her, I said, you used to look at a video and see around the way girls,
right,
being featured and loved and getting play.
Right.
And I mean, like girls with the earrings,
girls.
Right, with like the mushroom perm cut,
right,
and the, you know, the earrings and, you know, cheap clothes,
right,
and, you know, glossy lips and all of that. And that, I mean, it's like gone the way of the dinosaur.
Yes.
I mean, if someone popped up like that on a video set, they'd probably be taken to an insane asylum. We found a relic from the late,
right,
hip-hop
80s. Right, right.
You know. And then, you know, one of the things I keep thinking to myself, just from the point of view, you know, now that we're adults and, you know, we're sort of the stewards of the children in our community, and as a parent, you know, a lot of what you said in your essay kind of gave me pause. And, you know, it's like the rhetoric and the cultural affirmation might only be one piece of what we need to provide for our children.
Right.
And, you know, they need support for processing and healing from the assaults on their minds and their spirits during racist and sexist encounters, or, you know, the messaging. And I'm just curious if you've thought about this, and, you know, even looking back on your childhood, you know, what are some of the things that you think would make coming of age easier for Black girls and Black children? Like, what are some of the specific things that we might be able to do better with our children in terms of the support for the processing?
Well, I'm not a parent, so I can just only go by my own experience. And of course, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but I think one really important element is to not only let children know that they're beautiful, and I say children purposely because it's really about boys too.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's about teaching boys not only that they are beautiful, but also showing them that the girls that they see are beautiful.
Exactly.
But, you know, being sure not to make children feel guilty or responsible for the world. And I don't want to, again, I don't want to imply that that was the direct message that I got out of my parents' mouths, because it wasn't. But it's the idea that, you know, there are so many problems in the world that you need to make a difference, that you are responsible for yourself and for your people and your community. And that if you have some feelings of inadequacy around that, or if you're in an environment that is counter to that, as my sister and I were at prep school, that you let children know that it's okay, you know, and that they're children.
Mm.
So, you know, that said, though, I do think that right now it would be dangerous to raise children without any sort of political consciousness, and that children really need to learn how to process media.
They and deconstruct to, images.
To deconstruct images, to understand where these images come from, to know that the video girl that they see every 5 minutes is actually just another version of the Jezebel, you know, to know that, you know, the women on Flavor of Love are a combination of the Jezebel and Sapphire.
Sapphire, right.
You know, tell it like it is Sapphire. Really identifying, even visually, and now we have access to these images because we have the internet. And there's this great site that I go to, the Jim Crow Museum.
Site.
I can't remember what college they're based in, but if you do a search, you'll find the Jim Crow
Museum
website. Mm-hmm. And they just show you point by point.
What a great resource.
What the images were. And you can compare them. You really can. And I think that can awaken the minds of children to see that, number one, if they have this, you know, maybe a slight feeling that something isn't right, it's because it isn't right.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, I remember those feelings. Like, you'd go to school and something might happen, you'd come home, and there'd just be this, like, it's almost like something from a cartoon. There's this lurking feeling, like, something's off today.
Right. Like, what? Yeah. What, or, like, what just happened?
Right. You the know, world what, is a mess.
Right. So, you know, I hope that answered your question.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm curious, how did your family respond to yours and your sister's essays?
They were very, very supportive and excited. I mean, you know, if they had a problem with it, I don't know about it.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily looking for conflict.
No,
I was just curious, right?
No, I know you weren't. But it just occurred to me just now. Like, the support was really unconditional, and the support was really important. I know for my essay, I read it to my parents before I published it, because although I'm a writer, I'm not one of those gangster writers that's like, this is my story, and so no matter how people feel about it, I'm putting it out there.
Right.
You know, which, that's not to take away from that. I think that's beautiful. That's just not, you know, that's not who I am. And the fact that they were supportive, and, you know, the fact that they weren't like, oh, don't air the dirty laundry, or, you know, whatever it was really, really significant.
Mm. Yeah, it felt like a cautionary tale for the conscious parents. I was like, oh, let me take notes.
But see, I really
I'm just giving you a hard time, Akiva.
No, because I actually had heard that from someone else. You know, another conscious parent, and I felt terrible because I'm like, that was not the intention.
Oh no, but I think it's great because it's a question. There are so many. Sort of conflicts, you know, and you know that you're doing the best as you, like, sign your child up for African Saturday School and, you know, get images in your home and of, you know, culturally affirming images and create these experiences. But, and all of that is so great, but then there's the reality of, like, okay, what am I going to do if someone, you know, says something to my child that's racist?
Right.
You know, how are these things going to help me? And these things are great because they set an environment, you know, or like a milieu in your home, but they are no substitute for the other things that you need to be doing. And your essay really points that out to us as adults in our community now. Like, hey, there's more work that we need to, there are more ways in which we need to be supportive and available to our children.
Right.
And so, yeah, I meant it more in that sense. And so for me as a parent, it's like a call to, you know, thinking more about, you know, what, how can I also support my child in these other real-world situations? Because it's not like you can tell them, well, just go stroke the kente cloth if you're not feeling good. You know? It's like, it's
right.
Not really going to do anything. So,
right.
And then, you know, one of the things that sort of was floating through my mind as I read the essays is that on the flip side of any dialectic about Black women is Black men.
Right.
And in most of these stories, encounters with Black men are critical aspects of how the women develop their sense of what is desirable, develop their sexual personas, their romantic relationship archetypes, mm-hmm. and their love lives, even their sexual identity or their gender identity. And I'm curious, what do you think these testimonies say about black men and black women and where we need to go from here as a community?
Well, I think the main thing that they say is, again, the same way we receive these messages, black men, men in general, are receiving them too. And so, you know, when we talk about educating our children and we talk about self-esteem, a lot of times it centers around girls.
Mm-hmm.
I have a self-esteem building community program for girls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's definitely not to take away from those programs. They are critical. But it's also important that we're educating boys simultaneously, because we can't have a bunch of girls running around who have the highest self-esteem in the world.
And high expectations.
And high expectations. And then they go out there and the boys just didn't get the memo. Like,
right.
You know, that creates a real contradiction within girls. And I think there's a story I want to share with you about Howard, because, you know, at Howard, I had a short natural pretty much the whole time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
When I say short, I mean it was a Caesar.
Yeah, that's why I was just about to say, I think I remember it was a Caesar.
Yeah, it was a Caesar.
It looked
cool.
You were wearing it very beautifully.
Well, thank you. But, you know, coming from, again, the household that I came from, and the fact that my mother has worn, with the exception of the past 4 years or so, my mother has had a short natural my entire life.
And my engineer is signaling me that we have to close, so I just need you to wrap up your story really quickly.
Oh, okay. Well, the upshot of it is this. Women would always tell me how beautiful it was. A few men would say, oh, you have a really pretty face. But when I left Howard, I found out that many people assumed that I was a lesbian because I had this short haircut.
Mm.
And, you know, if I were a lesbian, great, but I'm actually not. And so the fact that, again, women had gotten the memo, men had not gotten the memo, it's just really important, I think, that we're all on the same page.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us, Women, Body, and Soul, for our discussion of the anthology, Naked, Black Women Bare All, about their hair, skin, hips, lips, and other parts, with editors Akiba Solomon and Ayanna Bird, a collection of essays available in bookstores and online. This is Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Natalie Tondiway. You can email me at wbsradio@mail.com, W like woman, B like body, S like soul, wbsradio@mail.com. Thank you, listeners.
And we move to all kinds of questions sometimes. Sometimes we, as black women, say, wow, what is going to happen to us? I mean, are we really loved or are we unloved? And you do a poem that simply be saying, black women chant. We stand before you, plain old black women. And what you gonna do with us, black men? You gonna protect us, treat us right, love us. Yeah, here now, black men, your black bitch. Queens, nigger women waiting for your sign that you be seeing us. We walk right up to you and turn your corner of beauty. Black men, do you see us, hear us, know us? Black men, we bees here waiting, 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 a long American wait. Hurry, 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 black men, warriors of black electricity, move, 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 move on to us, yo, high vote. Women.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to. Peace.
Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. My mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God, oh my God.
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and on the web at WBAI.org. It's 1 p.m. in New York City. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. So many things to pay attention to nowadays. Are you the audience?